once again, I would maybe choose half, one half or the other, personally, because 17 to 20, for my money, is the most, theologically, the most challenging paragraph in the whole gospel. Whereas the salt and light sayings are a little more straightforward. So, you know, if you're going to preach on this text, it wouldn't hurt my feelings if I were in the congregation if you'd go with 13 to 16 or 17 to 20. But to do both means you better serve a lunch in the middle of the sermon because it's going to take a while. So after the Beatitudes, which you may know, I think, are gospel, they lift up the people, they pronounce unexpected and long-lasting and present and future blessing upon the disciples of Jesus. So this, the Beatitudes are gospel. The disciples have been lifted really high by what Jesus has just been said, what he has just said. And then, right on the heels, comes their calling. And he begins, "You are, himes este, the salt of the earth. You salt the earth." And I think it's probably a good idea not to limit, you know, one of the functions of salt in the ancient world. It's preservative, it's flavoring, it's all kinds of things. Somebody said recently that you rubbed salt on a baby's skin to shrivel it up. No, to make it contract. I never did understand that comment. So if you know anything about that, let me know. So you disciples are the preservative and the flavor in this, you know, rotten and insipid world. Oh, that was kind of good. Write that down. But if the salt becomes foolish, or has become foolish, to preserve the metaphor, loses its flavor, entini halesthesitai. Now, this is interesting. Entini is probably a dative of means. By means of what will it be salted? Now, I had a thought once recently that, I mean, it's normally taken, how will the salt be salted? That is sort of, how will you inject saltitude back into it? But I don't know if this is right or not, but I wondered if the it is the earth. You know, if the salt loses its flavor, how will it be salted? How will the earth be salted if there's no salt with any flavor in it? You could go either way. And again, I think the typical way is, you know, that the salt now has to be salted in the sense of be restored to saltiness, something like that. Question. If it doesn't happen, then the next thing follows. Esuden, for nothing, or to nothing, ischi, it is strong, or it's good for nothing, still, eti, except, eme, kata patestai, go to the infinitive, except, it is good for this, to be trampled under, now maybe catch the participle, blathen, which is neuter, because the implied logical subject of the infinitive is neuter, namely, ta halas. It is good for nothing except after being thrown exo out to be trampled, a present infinitive passive, to be trampled under. I realize that that's almost onomatopoetic because what does it sound? Katapateo. Katapateo. That's the way I remember that verb. It occurs twice in Matthew. To be trampled by people, by men. So, this is calling, you know, this is who you are as the people of God. Don't become unsalty, right? Otherwise, you're good for nothing except to be trampled under by unbelievers. Verse 14, you are the light of the world. Easy enough. Both of these genitives, by the way, salt of the earth and light of the world, I think are objective. You salt the earth. You light the world. You give light or shed light into the world. Udinatai polis. Let's see, keep going. Kribenai epano arus kemene. This participle at the end, you kind of have to do something with. It's a little bit far away to be adjectival, so I want to make it temporal. I mean, maybe not temporal, but conditional. A city, if it is set, or if it lies epano arus, upon a mountain or upon a hill, udinatai kribenai, is not able to be hid. Now, we just had this crypto we had in beginning Greek. I see Chris over here is remembering this. This is one of those aorist infinitive passives. The sixth principal part of crypto doesn't have the theta eta. It's one of those like grapho. It's not graphthane. It's not egraphthane. It's egraphane. And crypto becomes ecribane. It's a little bit irregular. But the nigh ending sort of gives it away. So a city, if it is set on a hill, is not able to be hidden. Right? I mean, Jesus has this way of using sort of inexorable logic. You know, this is true, isn't it? And everybody has to say, yes, that's correct. And then verse 15, neither do they, kaiuzin, do they light a lamp, a lichnan, and put, tethazin, do they put it under a bushel basket, sort of an absurd image. Rather, Allah, they put it, you supply that verb, epitein lichnion, they put it on a lampstand. You put a lichnas on a lichnion, that makes sense. Kai lampe pasantois ente oikia, and it lights all the ones in the house. And everybody goes, yeah, this is correct. Now, since it's true that you are the light of the world, namely, by virtue that you are my disciples, Jesus is saying, and by virtue of all the gifts that I give, in this way, verse 16, lamsato tafos himon emprastanton anthropon. In this way, third person imperative, let your light shine. It's hard to translate in English, but that's the way we normally do it. Let your light shine in the presence of other people. This is the hard part, because in chapter 6, Jesus will repeatedly say, don't do your righteousness in order to be seen by men. See? The question is one of motive, right? I mean, in order to be admired by men, I think is the sense of chapter 6. Here the motive is, and this is, even with this clarification, it's still unbelievably hard, to do good works so that people will be impressed with God and not with me. See? And that, I haven't quite mastered that yet. Still working on that. Hapos with the subjunctive expresses purpose, for this purpose, so that they see of you the beautiful works, or the noble works, the good works. They see your good works, and they glorify the Father of you, your Father, the one in the heavens. To preach this, you know, I think there's the gospel is strongly implicit in the indicatives. You are salt. You are light. You know, it's not make yourself salt. I mean, there isn't much explicit gospel in this little paragraph, but it follows right on the heels of the Beatitudes, whereby Jesus has pronounced his present and future blessing upon his disciples. So in that context, you have been made to be, almost like I will make you fishers of men, right? I will do it. I've made you to be salt. I've made you to be light. So the gospel's power is always behind that. Okay, verse 17, we'll keep going. Now it gets tough. Me numizeta, don't think this, that I came, Elthan, for this purpose, to abrogate or abolish the Old Testament. Tanuman he tus prophetas. Now, I was hoping that both the Old Testament exegetes would leave before we got to this verse, because we true Marcionites would like to abrogate the Old Testament, but we're not going to do that because Jesus says he didn't come for this purpose. You get that, Paul? I'm kind of digging there at you. He's ignoring me. I did not come, uke elthon, katalisai, to abrogate, but to fulfill. Big Matthean word. It means to enact, to carry out all to which the Old Testament pointed, right? It's a salvation history word. It's an eschatology word. This is Christ's purpose. He doesn't come to abolish it or to abrogate it. He comes to fulfill it. And it implies, I think, two things. First of all, something's changing now, but it also implies continuity. Because it hasn't just come to do away with it, but to fulfill it. It has been validly pointing forward to him. For truly I say to you, verse 18, Haosan, until the heaven, ha uranos kai he ge par elthe, until the heaven and the earth pass away, one iota or one hook, I don't know, it's probably a yod or some funky accent mark or something, ume par elthe, ume with the aorist subjunctive is strong negative prohibition, or future negation will certainly not pass away from the law. Now another heos on clause, until all things happen. What does this mean? Well, I suppose there's two schools of thought here. There's about five or ten, actually, but the two schools of thought are that Jesus is, the heos clauses refer to the last day. Okay, that not one jot or tittle of the law will pass away until all things happen. At which point you have to start interpreting jot and tittle of the law. Okay, and there's different ways to do that. You can do it validly. But if you take the until clauses as referring to the eschaton, you have to argue in some way that the Old Testament, even to its smallest detail, remains, has not passed away. For instance, it couldn't be in the sense of all the commandments remain in force because, you don't do sacrifices anymore and you can sow two kinds of seed in one field and that's not a problem and things like that. It's interesting, Cameron McKenzie, who's on the faculty up at Fort Wayne, did his STM on this passage under Veltz, when Veltz was up there. And he argues that, I'm not convinced, but he argues that it's the law viewed as Christological, as prophetic, as bearing prophetic witness to Christ. That every and he takes the jot and the tittle to refer quite literally to the text of the Old Testament. That the whole text of the Old Testament will not pass away until the end of the world. Because even though the Christ has now come to fulfill it, it continues to give its prophetic witness to him. Now, theologically, that's very engaging. I have a hard time believing it, exegetically. I think, and my view is certainly not without problems, I think that, in a sense, the second until clause informs the first. So that we'd have to take this heaven and earth passing away as either figurative speech or an emphatic way of saying never, and give heavier weight to until all things take place. And I think that, I'm following John Meyer here, the guy at Catholic University, that refers to the death and resurrection of Jesus. That he hasn't come simply to do away with the law, but to fulfill it. And when he fulfills it, when all things happen, then jots and tittles will in fact begin to pass away from the law. Okay. But again, this is a very difficult verse. We'll just keep going. We're almost out of time. Verse 19. Therefore, whoever looses one of the commandments, these ones, the least of them, whoever looses one of the least of these commandments, and here I think the sense, as in as much as you did it to one of the least of these, my brothers, same construction, the sense is even the least, and teaches, whoever teaches in this way to people, to men, least will be called in the kingdom of heaven. I think this person is in the kingdom of heaven because, the least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than John the Baptist and some similar parallels like that. But what this conclusion that Jesus does, note the un, what it does is that it magnifies the importance of doing and teaching these commandments. In other words, it's really important to do that. Now, another problem occurs. What is the referent of these commandments? Right? And I think, again, there's lots of argumentation for and again all these views. I think they're the commandments that he's about himself to articulate, the so-called antitheses of 5:21-48. It is very important. Greatness in the kingdom of heaven will be acknowledged to those who were obedient and taught in this way. Obedience is very important to Jesus, in other words. And on the last day, its importance will be shown. Harold, you had a comment? No. I was hoping you might have a definitive answer. Right.
Mm-hmm. But you're saying it actually references
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, and... Oh, yeah, it is. They all are. That's the problem. Yeah, yeah. Really, I mean, we spent... I have this Matthew seminar on Tuesday afternoons, and we spent... Dave Maxwell, who, as you all know, is a great student and a good exegete, he spent an hour and a half leading us through just this paragraph, trying to figure out what he did was a magnificent job of laying out all the interpretive options and what are the positive strengths and weaknesses of each position, and they've all got strengths and weaknesses. That's the problem here. Yeah. That's why I'm recommending that you preach on salt and light. Well, that's the problem. Is it referring to these commandments which are in the Numas, which is the law of Moses? Or is it these commandments which you're about to hear? Yeah. So, anyway, there's arguments. Well, let's finish. For I say to you, verse 20, that, Hati, unless, and may, your righteousness, himon he dikaiousino, abounds, perisiuse, in a manner greater, pleon, greater of the scribes and Pharisees, ume eis elthete, you will certainly not, on the last day, eis erchomai into the basileia, as always, last day in Matthew, you will certainly not on the last day enter into the reign of heaven. Now, what does this mean? Okay? It means that you don't preach on this text, okay? Because it'd take too long to explain. Right? And we're out of time. No. No, we would have run out of time if I'd had another 10 minutes. Right, right. Yeah, there are questions about the relationship of this text to the antitheses that follow. One clue that I think is of some significance, however, is the verb periseuo in Matthew. Look up periseuo, and you will discover that it's always, in other places, it's a verb in which God is the giver of abundance. And I think that's of some significance here. That whence this abundant righteousness... It's the gift of God. Now, whether you understand that as sort of forensically or eschatological, soteriologically, or good works, the answer would still be it comes from God. He abounds. And you know, it'd be interesting if I kept on talking, it would be just me and Brian at the microphone back there. So I'll stop. Yeah.